Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Today, we look at the results of the November elections, and my guests are Sean O'Keefe and Phil Palmisano. Professor O'Keefe holds the Fansteel Chair in Leadership at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship. In the past, he has served in both Bush administrations, including as Secretary of the Navy and head of NASA. And he's also been Chairman and CEO of Airbus and the Chancellor of Louisiana State University. Assemblyman Palmisano serves in the New York State Assembly. He represents the 132nd District. Prior to that, he served in the Steuben County Legislature. Assemblyman Palmisano, Professor O'Keefe, welcome to the program. And Sean, when are you going to finally get a real job?
Well, when you've got one to offer, I'm all ears. Well, between, I've got to just keep doing what I'm doing. You know?
Thanks to the two of you for being here. Sean, I'll start with you. People who are listening to this program have most likely already heard a bunch of other commentaries by now. And so let me put the first question to you this way. What did you learn from the results of the election that you did not already know about the political situation in the United States before the election?
Well, I think the most frequently cited issue that we've been dealing with and that opinion writers have had plenty to say about is the division in the country. And there's been arguments over whether this is new or whether it's a first in history or whether this is just a cyclical challenge. And so that part was confirmed. There's no doubt there's a very strong division within the country, and we're still trying to sort through the reasoning for it. But what I think was most profound that I think we learned from this is the depth of frustration of the public. The extraordinary, I want to send a message kind of theme that varied depending upon constituency. And there was not a uniform voice in terms of the frustration. It was a collection of things. And, you know, the commentary as well as post, you know, voting surveys and so forth have all indicated there was a fair amount. It'll be interesting to see statistically what level it was of ticket splitting going on that was rather unusual in some places and almost unheard of in others. So that's a significant learning, you know, effort that needs to be reflected on. And hopefully we can turn the discussion and debate, public debate over the division in the country to more of a, what is it going to take to work through the frustrations that so many have expressed in the course of this time?
Yeah, I want to get into some of those things a little bit later, but Assemblyman Palmisano, is there anything you want to add to what Professor O'Keefe said?
Sure. I mean, first of all, it's a privilege and honor to be on this program with both of you. When I was asked to do it, I said, I'd be happy to. I agree with Sean too. I mean, I think going into this election day, I mean, we knew it was a very divisive election. It was well documented. You see it on the news, you see it on TV, social media, everything. And I think, you know, how it turned out, I mean, from my perspective, we knew it was going to be a close race, and it really was a close race. I mean, Electoral College, it doesn't look like that, but at one point either way, it could have shifted this race. And I think a lot of things came into play in that. And as I looked at this going into this race, like I would talk to my children or talk to other people, I think it was really going to be a matter of what the voters voted when they went to the ballot box, whether it was the issues or the personality. There's certainly a lot of focus on the personalities of the individuals, the candidates, but also the issues. And at least my takeaway from it was that the voters were frustrated, as Sean said, and they wanted to send a message, but they were frustrated based on the issues, and that's how they voted. They voted with their pocketbook. We know the economy, you see statistics out there, if the economy was bad or worse, you know, 69% of those people voted for Donald Trump. Same thing with the inflation, you know, two-thirds of the people voted for Donald Trump. Immigration issue, which was highly profound, we've heard of it for years. Those individuals voted for Donald Trump. We even saw issues with, polls where it said who wanted change or leadership. Those people broke heavily for Donald Trump. The biggest issues, I think, too, with this whole election is how I think Donald Trump outperformed how he did with certain constituencies compared to 2020 and Kamala Harris underperformed, and we saw those stats going up throughout election night, whether it was with Latino voters, Latino men, younger voters, even Black men, all those results that were coming in were showing a shift in how Donald Trump outperformed and how Kamala Harris didn't. You even saw it in New York State, where they said this was the highest shift in votes for Donald Trump. You know, I think in 2 years, 2020, he lost 60%, and it was 55-44 this time around. So I think really the clearest message is that people voted with their pocketbook, how they're feeling. I mean, they could see the negative ads on TV, but they still have to go into the grocery store, and you'll see it's $6 for butter or, you know, eggs, or going to get gas in their car. They remember that. They're hurting, you know, and I think it goes down to that question that Ronald Reagan asked back in 1980. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And overwhelmingly, I think people aren't, based on the economy, based on inflation, and based on things like immigration and crime and public safety. And I think that's what kind of resulted in the vote that we saw, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I think more unhappy votes than happy votes, I would say. But Phil, let me just stick with you briefly here.
Sure.
And say, you mentioned the vote for Donald Trump in New York State. Anything in New York State that really surprised you, really, really caught you off guard in the results?
No, I mean, I think it was kind of a stretch to think that Donald Trump would win New York. But I think, really, I think what people look at is, you know, the margin of victory for Kamala Harris in New York was not as strong as they expected. And New York was out of the equation anyway, because even though Donald Trump might have performed well in New York City, in the suburbs, and everywhere across the state, his numbers were better. But I think what that signified is when you looked at the analysis election night, they went down to Pennsylvania and they looked at Philadelphia, how Donald Trump was outperforming where he did 4 years ago, and Kamala Harris was underperforming. I remember looking at a poll or a discussion in Illinois and how they looked out there in the areas, even though Donald Trump lost it, how he was outperforming. So it kind of really, it's kind of a message that was going across throughout the election evening. And I think the other thing that I thought was interesting, Sean, Grant, I saw a statistic. They said on one of the news stations where they showed a list of the counties where Donald Trump outperformed himself from 2020 by 3% or more. It was lit up all the way across the board. And then they did the same thing for Kamala Harris. There was nothing lit up. She did not outperform herself by 3% by 2020 numbers at all. So I think that just says a clear message that, you know, what they were talking about, and it seemed like, the Democrats wanted to focus on, you know, Trump personality, you know, using things like fascist, dictator, racist, garbage, and then even, you know, Governor Hochul, our governor last week, said that people who voted for Republicans and Donald Trump are anti-American and anti-woman. I think that's going to come back to bite her as she decides to run for governor again, because I think, you know, 3.2 million people in New York voted for Donald Trump. So is that what she's saying to those voters? She doesn't want those voters. So I think it's just a kind of a pattern that I saw watching the analysis election, even some of the research I did for this show.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. And I see, I saw that same statistic about the counties, and I believe that number was 90%. 90% of the counties across the country, Trump had improved what he had done from the previous election. And on Trump winning New York State, I have to share this with the two of you and our listeners. I told my students, I have to teach a big American politics class. I told my students, so one of them asked me, is Trump going to win New York? And I said, if Trump wins New York, I will teach the next class in my pajamas. But when the results came in, I thought that was a little closer shave than I thought. Sean, let me turn to you and I ask you a thought experiment here. Let's imagine that you're writing a memo to the Democratic National Committee right now. What lessons would you be drawing out for them? I know it's early days, but.
Well, the first one is in part a commentary as well on the previous dialogue we just had, which is, this is all relative, all the comparisons relative to 2020 and 2016. The Harris campaign was exactly 107 days long. That was it. She was not envisioned as a nominee or a candidate even before that. She didn't even, you know, make it through the beginning of the primary season. So in so many ways, what she was jamming into that period of time was introducing herself much more deeply to the American public, and in a way that thematically was picking up on the continuing issues that had been under debate over the preservation of the democracy and basic governance principles and so forth, that I think, as Phil said, didn't resonate with a lot of folks, because they're saying, okay, that's interesting, but by comparison to the cost of living that I'm experiencing, this doesn't make any sense to me. So that's just not an issue. So I think the first issue to draw from that would be in the memo is re-engage on the effort of getting to know the American public, okay, and where the sentiments reside, and then fashioning the nature of the agenda around those issues, which, whether you think they're the more important ones or not, they must be addressed up front. And there was an element of just kind of moving past that. Oh, yes, that's stipulated. We all know that inflation is declining and we all know the economy is improving. The answer is no, we don't. There's an awful lot of folks who just don't, they could see the statistics, but that doesn't mean anything to them directly, the individual. So as a consequence, this is what accounts for this ticket splitting and, you know, voting on one issue in one direction and voting for a different candidate in another. They're diametrically opposed to that. And I think that's an object lesson that was lost in the campaign going forward, and wasn't nearly as dominant, again, as Phil said, on the economy, on immigration, on the issues that everybody repetitively kept, you know, or at least the polls would suggest that a majority of Americans were most concerned about those issues. And instead, they're talking about third and fourth tier issues that are important, maybe important to you, maybe important to me, maybe important to Phil. I mean, but this certainly didn't resonate with the majority of the public. That's you know, is one issue, and that would consume the memo.
Well, and just to follow up on that and to tie it to one of the patterns that we saw, that Trump really made some inroads with the working class, middle class, people with less formal education. You know, the economy has been great if you're an investor. I mean, if you're an investor, it's been wonderful, but not everybody is an investor. And so if you're only experiencing the inflation side, then you're going to have a different experience. So Phil, I want to ask you the same thought experiment. Sure. And maybe you could give me part of it. And if we need to, we'll do it after the break, because we got to take a break here soon. But let's imagine that you're writing a memo to the Republican National Committee, because, you know, you're the Republican. What should the Republicans be taking from the results, other than, you know, spiking the football in the end zone? What else should they be learning?
Right. And if I may just briefly add, I was adding a memo to the Democrats, I'd say, do not blame the voters. I saw pundits on TV blaming the voters. I saw people blaming Latino men for not looking out for their Latino sisters. These people voted, and we're trying to send a clear message. They're frustrated. They're hurting. You can't get out there and blame the voters, and you need to really look into what the voters are saying. So now my message to the Republicans would be, listen, you've been provided a great opportunity, but you need to work together. Don't spike the ball. Yes, there's a mandate, but you have to address these issues that you were talking about, the economy, inflation, immigration, crime, and safety. But also, I think try to do it in a way, always try to reach out. I think try to be civil about it. I mean, I don't think you want to get, I mean, it was a visceral election, you know, so the back and forth, obviously. But my memo to the Republicans is like, you know, act on what you were told to do, or the mandate you have, because if you don't, if the Republicans get control of the House, that'd be 2 years of total control. They have to get things done. If they don't, if they bicker and fight, if they're trying to do things that the voters weren't talking about, and addressing in their votes, I think that can come back and bite them 2 years from now when the House is up for re-election again, all 435 seats in the next round of Senate. So I think listen to what the voters told you. I mean, there's logic and good information behind that. Focus on those issues. People are hurting. They want people to lead and help address this matter, and they want to address this soon. So we'll see how that portrays as we move forward.
Yeah, I think that's sound advice. And I think your point back to the Democrats about blaming the voters, not doing that is important. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm discussing the November elections with New York State Assemblyman Phil Pomisano and Syracuse University professor Sean O'Keefe. Sean, you've had experience in the executive branch, quite a bit of it. And so also you have dealt with Congress and know Congress. What do you expect to see in the next 2 to 4 years in terms of that dynamic between the White House and the Congress, given what the results are?
Well, I think it's twofold. First of all, with the Congress, that's a specific set of challenges. But also within the government itself, within the workforce that is part of the federal government, that is responsive to the administration's agenda, that's going to be a challenge as well. The first part, as it pertains to Congress, right out of the box, from day one, on January 20th, there will be a series of nominations served up to the United States Senate to consider confirming the appointment of individuals that are nominated by the President of the United States. The habit has been of both parties, okay, they're both guilty of it, is those who oppose the candidate will hold it and delay on the action. And those who are in support are in complete frustration that they can't move forward because of what's referred to as the 60 vote rule, the cloture motions and all the other things that procedurally that go on. And so the real test is going to be whether or not the president-elect has the capacity to actually engage with the majority leader, which will now be a Republican, to be named by next week by the caucuses of the Republican caucus, and with the minority as well, which is presumably going to be Chuck Schumer is the minority leader in the United States Senate, to try to exact a pledge that says, let's stop this business of just ending everything cold and instead a delay and constant deferral and so forth. Let's act. And if you object to it, by all means, let your voice be heard in the negative, but let's move on, count the votes, and get moving with that. That'll be the big first test of his leadership, is driving home his own agenda by appointing people who he believes, you can bet he does, firmly believe that the administration that he's going to be appointing are those who will carry out that instruction. You got to get there first. And so far, the Senate in particular has shown a propensity not to do so. The House is a whole different matter. Again, as the assemblyman mentioned, it's still up in the air, but this could easily end up being, a Republican majority, not by much.
Right.
And so the issue that's going to haunt, the next administration, same way it did the current one, is the challenge of getting through what the majority wants to do. There are structurally 30 members of the House of Representatives who have voted no on every single thing because they'd rather see the entirety of the process burn down than to have it move in a direction that may move some progress forward towards resolution.
You're talking about the Freedom Caucus.
Yes,
right?
Sir. I mean, okay. this is stalemate, and it's going to stay that way until and unless the president-elect can compel those in opposition to get with the program and start to voice their objections, but let's move it forward. And that's going to be the same message that he's got to give to the Senate Majority Leader as a means to actually accomplish the fundamental blocking and tackling of confirming appointees. The federal workforce is a different problem. I mean, there's already a trove of different, editorial comments and everything else that are out in the broader discussion of those feeling that those who are public servants who are not political, they're not partisan, they're there because of their expertise and working through issues. The president-elect has made it quite clear that he intends to go back to what he attempted to do at the end of his first term and to eliminate the most senior levels of those career appointees or career public servants who are there for that kind of condition and make it possible to appoint anybody he chooses without confirmation. That's a privilege that is afforded to the president at a certain level. Well, he's going to maximize that to a factor of 10 greater than what it was. At least that was his actual executive order direction that he put in motion in the last 6 months of his administration previously. This time, I think he wants to make it stick. He's indicated all that, you know, by every comment he's ever made. And his team is very much committed to that same proposition as well. And they've got 40,000 people standing in line who want to take those positions going forward. This is going to be a challenge with dealing with the career force, the 1.5 million people, and those in uniform who are there not at the discretion of the president. They're there because of their expertise and so forth. How do you mobilize everybody to actually follow the lead of a much larger contingent of those who have a partisan agenda? That has been antithetical to the way that, you know, the United States, that Americans have looked to support this in the last 140 years. That's reversing a major shift. And we're back to something that is now based on a patronage system than it is a merit system. And that is that's going to be a huge challenge given the nature of the leadership.
Yeah, it's an important point that's not getting a whole lot of discussion right now. Well, Assemblyman Pompisano, I want to leave a little bit of time at the end so we can dig into New York a little bit. But let me ask you this question first. How do you think the Republican Party will need to think about its future after Trump? Because there's only going to be 4 more years of him. He's already getting on in age. What's the party do after that? Do they have a discussion about whether we want to continue on this vein, take a new tack? Will it be driven by the leaders that emerge? I mean, obviously, J.D. Vance is a very ambitious guy, and he's young and he's smart. So he's probably thinking of 2028, probably right now. So where do you see the party going without Trump there long term?
Well, I think before we get there, I think we went through the campaign season. Now we got to get to the governing season.
Right.
They were tasked with governing. And I think how they govern is going to dictate how things go in the future when candidates did arise, candidates that don't arise. And I think, and as Sean hit a lot of good points, I mean, this Congress is going to be, if they keep the majority, it's going to be very narrow Congress majority. And we saw what happened over the past 2 years with how many different speakers went through the pike and got then they were going to be the speaker, then they weren't because of a small fraction. And I think President Trump's going to need to really, you know, bring them in and say, listen, we have an agenda that we have to deliver for the American people. And if we want to be successful in governing and also successful in the next 4 years, because in 4 years, they're going to be asking the question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And I think the results of how they govern is really going to dictate that and send that message. And they have to remember, I mean, the Republican Party has always been kind of noted, and even the Democrats try to portray them as a party of the rich. But if you look at the statistics from the vote that happened, those individuals under $50,000 in income, those under $100,000 in income went for Donald Trump, not by a large margin, but they did go for Donald Trump. Those over $100,000 went for Kamala Harris. So there's something in these numbers. They got to remember the working people. They got to remember this broad coalition, and they have to be able to communicate effectively because, again, we're in the governing season now, and they have to be able to govern in a way and communicate that message back to those people that supported them. So when the other side might say, hey, they're for the rich, you got to say how this is going to benefit the working people, because there's more people making under $100,000 and under $50,000 than there are making over $100,000. And you have to show how this economy, this plan, whether it's the economic tax cuts, regulations, migration, all those things have to come into play. And I think based on how they do, especially these first 2 years, is really going to set the tone for the 2 years after, because after the next 2 years, that's when the candidates start getting out there. I mean, right after the midterm elections, it's going to be a 2 year cycle. So, but they really have to act responsibly, I think civilly, communicate properly and with their message and how this is going to improve the lives and the quality of life of families, farmers, small businesses, manufacturers, and working men and women.
So let me stick with you, and we've got about 2 minutes left. So, we'll have to be brief here, but I wanted to ask you about the state results in particular? And if anything, two questions, I guess. And if there's any time left, Sean will get the last word. But two questions. What in particular caught your eye at the state level? And secondly, and this is my favorite question about the state of New York, so many people have heard it before, but do you see any evidence that Battleship New York is about to start turning when it comes to spending? Or are we going to have yet another record-setting budget? But take those in either order in about, you know, a minute if you can.
I mean, I think the state side and what to take away from the federal, number one, I mean, New York spends way too much money. I mean, under one party control since 2019, it's increased $66 billion or 38%. I think sometimes my colleagues on the other side of the aisle think it's their money and not the people's money. I mean, families, farmers, small businesses, they're all tightening their belts. It doesn't seem like state government wants to do that. And if you look at the issues, inflation, the economy, the migrant crisis, we were talking about those in our races, and I think they resonated. I mean, you know, I wish we would have had more success with some of that, but I mean, the migrant crisis alone, New York spent $4.3 billion over the last two budget cycles for the migrant crisis. That's more than we spend on veterans, homeless, and seniors combined. We must do a better job in the sanctuary city, sanctuary state, and the crime agenda. Those are things we need to address. And I think that's going to come as we move forward into the next cycle.
Okay, great. And Sean, we just have a few seconds left. I want to put one challenge to you. There are going to be a lot of listeners to this program that were really unhappy about what happened on Tuesday. Can you give them a one or two sentence line of hope?
The democracy and this entire American experiment is just that. We've been 250 years at working through the will of the people, and that's what this is an expression of. Whether you like that answer and whether you like that conclusion or not, that's the determination. And that's what separates us from so many others around the world and make us the envy of them.
That's a good note to end on. That was Sean O'Keefe and Phil Pomisano. Assemblyman Pomisano, Professor O'Keefe, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Grant.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, and the program is edited by Mark Livonia. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and listen to previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.